The prospect of wading the river was particularly uninviting. The rain had fallen without a break for days now, and the water sounded powerful and swift. It would certainly be icy cold, and probably shoulder deep rather than waist deep. The bridge must be only a few hundred yards downstream, and he stood up and moved along the bank. Cold and pain can sap concentration very swiftly, and Peter had to make a conscious effort to keep himself alert, and he felt for every foothold before transferring his weight forward. He held the cobra hanging at full stretch of his right arm, but ready for instant use, and he blinked his eyes clear of the fine drizzle of rain and the cold sweat of pain and fear. Yet it was his sense of smell that alerted him. The rank smell of stale Turkish tobacco smoke on a human body. It was a smell that had always offended him, and now he picked it up instantly, even though it was just one faint whiff. Peter froze in mid-stride, while his brain raced to adjust to the unexpected. He had almost convinced himself that he was alone. Now he remembered the sound of a car engine on the main road, and he realized that men who had set up such an elaborate decoy, the faked motor accident, the police van and uniform, would certainly have taken the trouble to plot and study the ground between the ambush point and the victim's intended destination. They would know better than Peter himself the layout of woods and river and bridge, and would have realized immediately that they had taken their first casualty, the futility of blundering pursuit through the dark. It was the smart thing to circle back and wait again, and they would choose the riverbank or the bridge itself. The only thing that troubled Peter was their persistence. They must know it was not Magda Altman. And then, even in this tense moment of discovery, he remembered the Citroën that had followed him down the Champs-Élysées. Nothing was what it appeared to be. And slowly he completed the step in which he had frozen. He stood utterly still, poised every muscle and every nerve screwed to its finest pitch. But the night was black, and the rush of the river covered all sound. Peter waited. The other man will always move if you wait long enough. And he waited with the patience of the stalking leopard, although the cold struck through to his bones and the rain slid down his cheeks and neck. The man moved at last. The squelch of mud and the unmistakable brush of undergrowth against cloth. Then silence. He was very close, within 10 feet. But there was no glimmer of light, and Peter shifted his weight carefully to face the direction of the sound. The old trick was to fire one shot at the sound and use the muzzle flash to light the target for a second shot, which followed it in almost the same instant of time. But there were three of them, and at 10 feet that machine pistol could cut a man in half. Peter waited. Then, from upstream, there was the sound of a car engine again, still faint, but fast approaching. Immediately somebody whistled faintly, a rising double note in the night, up towards the bridge, clearly some prearranged signal. A car door banged shut, much closer than the sound of the approaching engine, and a starter whirred. Another, harsher engine roared into life. Headlights flared through the rain, and Peter blinked as the whole scene ahead of him lit up. 100 yards ahead, the bridge crossed the stream. The surface of the water was shiny and black as new-mined coal as it flowed about the supporting piles. The blue van had parked on the threshold of the bridge, obviously to wait for Peter, but now it was pulling out, probably alarmed by the approach of the other, more powerful engine from the direction of La Pierre Benite. The driver was heading back towards the main road, the phony gendarme scrambling alongside with his cape flapping as he tried to scramble through the open offside door. And out of the darkness, close to Peter, a voice cried out with alarm, "Attendez!" The third man had no desire to be left by his companions, and he ran forward, abandoning all attempt at concealment. He had his back to Peter now, waving the machine pistol frantically, clearly outlined by the headlights of the van, and the range was under 10 feet. It was a dead shot, and Peter went for it instinctively, and only at the very instant of trigger pressure that would have sent a 95-gram bullet between his shoulder blades was Peter able to check himself. The man's back was turned, and the range would make it murder. Peter's training should have cured him of such nice, gentlemanly distinctions. However, what really held his trigger finger was the need to know. Peter had to know who these people were and who had sent them, and what they had been sent to do, who they were after. Now that the man was being deserted, he had abandoned all stealth and was running as though he was chasing a bus, and Peter saw the chance to take him. Roles had been exchanged completely, and Peter darted forward, transferring the cobra to his injured left hand. He caught the man in 4 paces, keeping low to avoid his peripheral vision, and he whipped his good right arm around the throat, going for the half Nelson and the spin that would disorientate the man before he slammed the barrel of the cobra against the temple. The man was quick as a cat. Something warned him, perhaps the squelch of Peter's sodden shoes, and he ducked his chin into his chest, rolling his shoulders and beginning to turn back into the line of Peter's attack. Peter missed the throat and caught him high, the crook of his elbow locking about the man's mouth, and the unexpected turn had thrown him slightly off balance. If he had the full use of his left arm, he could still have spun his victim. But in an intuitive flash he realized that he had lost the advantage. Already the man was twisting his head out of the arm lock, bulking his shoulders, and by the feel of him, Peter knew instantly that he was steel hard with muscle. The barrel of the machine pistol was short enough to enable him to press the muzzle into Peter's body just as soon as he completed his turn. It would tear Peter to pieces like a chainsaw. Peter changed his grip slightly, no longer opposing the man's turn, but throwing all his weight and the strength of his right arm into the same direction. They spun together like a pair of waltzing dancers, but Peter knew that the moment they broke apart, the man would have the killing advantage again. The river was his one chance. He realized that instinctively, and before the advantage passed back from him to his adversary, he hurled himself backwards, keeping his grip on the other man's head. They went out into black space, falling together in a short, gut-swooping drop with Peter underneath. If there was rock below the steep bank of the river, he realized he would be crushed by the other's weight. They struck the surface of the fast black water, and freezing cold struck like a club, so that Peter almost released the air from his lungs as a reflex. The shock of cold water seemed to have stunned the man in his grip momentarily, and Peter felt the whoosh of air from his lungs as he let go. Peter changed his grip, wedging his elbow under the chin, but not quite able to get at the throat. Immediately the man began the wild, panic-stricken struggles of somebody held under icy water with empty lungs. He had lost the machine pistol, for he was tearing at Peter's arms and face with both hands as the water swirled them both end over end down towards the bridge. Peter had to keep him from getting air, and as he held his own precious single breath, he tried to get on top and stay there. Fingers hooked at his closed eyes, and then into his mouth, as the man reached back desperately over his own shoulders. Peter opened his mouth slightly, and the other man thrust his fingers deeply in, trying to tear at his tongue. Immediately Peter locked his teeth into the fingers, with a force that made his jaw ache at the hinges, and his mouth filled with a sickening warm spurt of the other man's blood. Fighting his own revulsion, he hung on desperately with teeth and arms. He had lost his own weapon, dropping it into the black flood from numbed and crippled fingers, and the man was fighting now with the animal strength of his starved lungs and mutilated fingers. Every time he tried to yank his hand out of Peter's mouth, the flesh tore audibly in Peter's ears, and fresh blood made him gag and choke. They came out on the surface, and through streaming eyes, Peter had one glimpse of the bridge looming above him. The blue van had disappeared, but Magda Altman's Mercedes limousine was parked in the centre of the bridge, and in the wash of its headlights he recognised her two bodyguards. They were leaning far out over the guardrail, and Peter had a moment's dread that one of them might try a shot. Then they were flung into the concrete piles of the bridge with such force that they lost the deathlock they had upon each other. The back eddy beyond the bridge swung them in towards the bank. Gasping and swallowing with cold and exhaustion and pain, Peter fought for footing on gravel and rock. The machine gunner had found bottom also and was stumbling desperately towards the bank. In the headlights of the limousine, Peter saw Magda's two bodyguards racing back across the bridge to head him off. Peter realized that he would not be able to catch the man before he reached the bank. "Carl!" he screamed at the bodyguard who was leading. "Stop him! Don't let him get away!" The bodyguard vaulted over the guardrail, landing cat-like in complete balance, with a pistol double-handed at the level of his navel. Below him, the machine gunner dragged himself waist-deep towards the bank. It was only then that Peter realized what was going to happen. "No!" he choked on blood and water. "Take him alive! Don't kill him, Carl!" The bodyguard had not heard or had not understood. The muzzle blast seemed to join him and the wallowing figure in the river below him, a blood-orange rope of flame and thunderous explosion. The bullet smacked into the machine gunner's chest and belly like an axeman cutting down a tree. "No!" Peter yelled helplessly. "Oh, Jesus, no, no!" Peter lunged forward and caught the corpse before it slid below the black water, and he dragged it by one arm to the bank. The bodyguards took it from him and hauled it up, the head lolling like an idiot's, and the blood diluted to pale pink in the reflected headlights. Peter made three attempts to climb the bank, each time slithering back tiredly into the water, and Carl reached down and gripped his wrist. Peter knelt on the muddy bank, still choking with the water and blood he had swallowed, and he retched weakly. "Peter!" Magda's voice rang with concern, and he looked up and wiped his mouth on the back of his forearm. She had slipped out of the back door of the limousine and was running back along the bridge, long-legged in black boots and ski pants, her face dead white with concern and her eyes frantic with worry. Peter pushed himself onto his feet and swayed drunkenly. She reached him and caught him, steadying him as he teetered. "Peter, oh God, darling, what happened?" "This beauty and some of his friends wanted to take you for a ride, and they got the wrong address." They stared down at the corpse. Carl had used a .357 Magnum, and the damage was massive. Magda turned her head away. "Nice work," Peter told the bodyguard bitterly. "He's not going to answer any questions now, is he?"
"You said to stop him," Carl growled as he reloaded the pistol.
"I wonder what you would have done if I'd said to really clobber him," Peter began to turn away with disgust, and pain checked him. He gasped. "You're hurt." Magda's concern returned in full strength. "Take his other arm," she ordered Carl, and they helped him over the parapet to the limousine. Peter stripped off the torn and sodden remains of his clothing, and Magda wrapped him in the Angora wool travel rug before examining his wound under the interior light of the cab. The bullet hole was a perfect little blue puncture in the smooth skin, already surrounded by a halo of inflammation, and the bullet was trapped between his ribs in the sheet of flat, hard trapezium muscles. She could see the outline of it quite clearly, the size of a ripe acorn in his flesh, swollen out angry purple. "Thank God," she whispered, and unwound the Jean Patou scarf from her long, pale throat. She bound the wound carefully. "We'll take you directly to the hospital at Versailles. Drive fast, Carl." She opened the walnut-fronted cocktail cabinet in the bodywork beside her and poured half a tumbler of whiskey from the crystal decanter. It washed the taste of blood from Peter's mouth and then went warmly all the way down his throat to soothe the cramps of cold and shock in his belly. "What made you come?" he asked, his voice still rough with the fierce spirit,
The timely arrival nagged at his sense of rightness. The police at Rambouillet had a report of a car smash. They knew the Maserati, and the inspector rang La Pierre Benite immediately. I guessed something bad. At that moment they reached the gates of the main road,